www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans with another Storage Unpack podcast, and I'm here with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad, Chris. I mean, we were just chatting before we started recording. We're now a year since our first lockdown, pretty much. So it's...
I think it is, isn't it? It's almost to the day, because I think... Yeah. Did Boris announce it on the 16th?
I think so, something like that.
And then it happened on the 23rd or something like that,
yeah.
I think, seem to remember.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Unbelievable. But yeah. I think we've all settled into working from home, haven't we? We've all got comfortable and used to it.
I think we all like it. I mean, as I say, Google keeps trolling me every month. This is where you visited this week, and it's just my normal walk. I start one place, I walk around the block a few times, and return home.
Yeah, I think I pretty much do the same. Apart from the odd trip to a supermarket, that's about it, really. Never mind. We're still ticking along. This week, though, we just have you and me. We don't have a guest this week. I think we've had a few weeks where we've had guests, but this week it's just the two of us. And we're going to discuss something I think you thought might be quite an interesting topic. And I think it's certainly becoming more interesting, and I think it's going to be more challenging for businesses over time. And that's the idea of multi-cloud storage. So why don't you just give people an idea of what you think the topic should be, and how we're going to dig into it.
This is something which is impinging more and more often on my world and in the world of a lot of people I know talking to. Companies trying to adopt multi-cloud. So that brings us some challenges, which we'll get into. So what do I mean by multi-cloud? Multi-cloud, obviously you've got the big cloud providers, you've got AWS, you've got Azure, you've got GCP. Also you have your private on-premises clouds, and your traditional on-premises data centers. So there's a challenge, and that is, how do we ensure our data is accessible across all of these data centers, whether it's a virtual data center or a physical data center? And it just seems to be a burgeoning requirement. I just talked to so many people about it, and nobody has quite got the answer quite yet. So I think it'd be just worthwhile talking about it. What do we mean? Why is anybody trying to do it? What do we think the challenges are? Who do we think is already trying to address it in the enterprise space, for example?
Okay, sounds great. And I think it's definitely a very interesting topic, simply because we know that over the last 12 months, being forced to work from home, or people working remotely, as we should call it, not working from home, because not everybody's working in their own house. They might be working remotely and going somewhere to work, rather than going into a central office in the center of a city. But I think as people have done that, there's an obvious more dispersal of the data and the compute. And also there's just more options, As an example, you could be using just a standard service provider. I don't know whether you've had a look at Equinix's Metal offering, which is basically a bare metal environment, and you can just spin up physical servers really, really quickly. So, there's so many options now to put your data in different places, to put your applications in different places. And inevitably, I guess, it becomes more likely that people will try and see how they can get the most out of these different infrastructures. So it makes sense to work out how on earth you're going to manage your data in that sort of situation.
Well, yeah, I think there's a big economic driver now. What we've seen over the past 12 months, and I think we're going to see more and more, is people starting to divest themselves of real estate. Now, at the moment, that real estate people are talking about is office space. But let's say you've sunk a lot of costs into data centers, but in these computing... So what you may find is everybody says, well, I'm clearing data space out, I'll just convert it into a data center. Well, you and I know that's not really very practical.
No.
It doesn't work like that. But if you're going to start divesting yourself of headquarters buildings obviously often have their data centers or very large computer rooms. So what are people going to do? How are they going to disperse that data? And then you have the companies who continue to grow. People talk about this. These past 12 months, we've seen... 5-10 years worth of digital transformation happen in 12 months. Well, that's probably driven data growth, computing environments, VDI environments, all kinds of things which have spun up. But people don't want to build new data centers. I don't think very many people are in the game of building new data centers. Building new data centers is time consuming, and you're sinking a lot of cost. So I think there's a real economic reason, an economic space reason why people will go into spread multi-cloud, but they're always going to keep a certain amount of on-premises data center space, certainly enterprises will.
Yeah, so I think I can probably think of 4 or 5 major projects where I was heavily involved in the building out of a data center. I did obviously the storage fabric and the storage side of things, but we built a few for a large American bank, shall we say, plus a couple of other banks. And the cost was enormous, you know, the planning, the cost, everything that you have to think about, from physical infrastructure cabling to the logical side of things, to how you're going to do things like replication, to how you're going to operate it, the infrastructure you've got to put in place to manage all the kit that's even in there. And I can't imagine any, and by the way, that's not even including the discussions where we talk about things when, in those days, when we were looking at things like three-phase power supplies and stuff like that. But that's not even including the overhead of kitting it out and all the rest of it, and the time and effort. I can't imagine why anybody would want to do that anymore, when you can go to a service provider and you can lease space and let them build the actual physical infrastructure. You could even put your own racks somewhere. You don't even have to build anymore. So yeah, cost-wise, crazy. Why would you bother? It just makes no sense whatsoever. There are plenty of other options to get around that.
But as I say, people still do have data centres, and they're going to want to sweat that asset. And mostly, if you look at, you've been in data centres, Chris, turning those into office space, even if there was a requirement to turn it into office space, well, most of them are dark. They're not something which is going to easily transform into an office space.
They're not. And also, most of them, especially anybody who's got any sense, started building their data centers in really obscure places that were cheap. So I did one near Thiel on the M4 near Reading. You know, you wouldn't want to work there. That was a pretty awful place. I did one in Croydon, which was next to the dump. So you certainly wouldn't want to work there. And it wasn't very safe. We were told not to walk out on your own at night. So there are lots of places where I think they just look for cheap space because they needed more space than you'd need for an office. And that's, you're right, they're going to keep that asset. They're going to keep it going. But they're not going to be converted into office space, I don't think.
No, I can't see it. Really can't see it. But I think people will maintain the use of them. Interesting. I think my data centers are probably quite expensive to take down as well. I have a sneaking suspicion. I don't know.
I would imagine so, yeah.
So there's that. So there's the space where you're going to keep it, but there is this ever-growing amount of data, ever-growing requirement of compute. And then why else would you look at multi-cloud? Well, I think we're seeing some real differentiators between various cloud providers. I think we do see Amazon have their strengths, Google have their strengths, Microsoft and former Azure have strengths. What do I mean by strengths? I think at the moment, and this is probably more perception than, or more a gut feel than anything I know for a fact, it feels like Google are probably better at AI and ML. They have that better services. Amazon seem to be, serverless seems to be very important to them, but their general purpose compute seems to be excellent. And then Microsoft, well, Azure, well, if you're going to want to host AD, you want to host Exchange, they're providing those back office functions, those office functions which we all know and love, and probably do a better job with Windows as well. I suspect they probably host Windows in a more efficient, better way. They make it, they write it, they know how it all hangs together.
Yeah. I'd imagine there's a certain degree of ebb and flow, though. You know, we all know that when we had on-premises kit and we had multiple vendors, sometimes we'd be really happy with that vendor. Then we might fall out of love with that vendor. Some vendors had a faster iteration rate with features and technology than others. So maybe you left ship at the point where you thought, oh, those guys seem to be coming up with better ideas in their technology. Let's go with them for a while. And I can't imagine that wouldn't be the case with the public cloud, where you see one of the cloud providers goes ahead with a certain feature set in a certain area, and suddenly you see a leap of their technology, and then the others catch up. And at that point, the question you have to ask is, do I want to be locked into a single provider purely and simply because that's where I put my first set of data? Or do I want to have a flexible way of being able to access the other technology in the other data centers if they suddenly come out with a better competitive tool?
And then there's the on-premises. And on-premises does have some advantages. For instance, you know where your stuff is to start with. So you actually know, if you have data sovereignty and data governance issues, you really need to know where it is. That's where you're going to keep it.
I think that's a fair point. And I think the other side of it is that if you're really determined that you have to look after this asset that you can't afford to lose, who are you going to trust? Are you going to trust yourself to look after it and know how many copies of it you've got where? Or are you going to hope that you don't see somebody's data center burn down or have an outage that really affects you and potentially could lose your data? Because at that point, they're not going to be liable for the financial loss of what happens if that data is lost. They're just going to, you know, give you service credits, or you might get some sort of compensation, but it won't keep your business going.
Yeah, I've had this discussion with people before, and if their data center burns down or this happens or that happens, we'll just sue them. Well, suing them doesn't really help that you've just gone out of business. Okay, you might then return some value to your shareholders, but you've still gone out of business because everybody's moved on.
Can you imagine if you were somebody like Barclays or Lloyd's or a bank that's worth billions and you sued a cloud provider? You'd be in court for years. And by which case, as you said, you know, the market's moved on, you're out of business and you're never coming back. Yes, okay, you might sue somebody to make sure the shareholders got some money, some payoff. But actually, you probably find yourself being sued because you hadn't put in place the proper process to look after your data. So, you know, you could be at risk yourself as an officer of the company.
It's really interesting, actually. The companies which you might want to sue, which are worth suing, they're almost too big to sue. You're just going to end up pulled through a court process, which is going to take years. And most companies which you think you could sue and fight them, they're actually too small to be worth suing them anyway.
Yeah.
Because they'll just fold and you might get some insurance money back from them. But as I say, it hasn't really helped you at all.
Yep.
And then,
So lots of benefits of looking after your data yourself.
And then there's the final thing, which is agility. Now, agility means about how quickly can you spin up new compute, but also the agility to move your workloads. So general purpose compute, we haven't seen it too much yet because we haven't seen the idea of a cloud broker. Well, I know there's been people who've talked about being a cloud broker, but you'd look at a system and say, okay, today Google's cheaper than Amazon, so I'm just going to run my workloads there. And the next day it moves back again. So you've got that agility, but also the ability to spin up and deal with peaks, obviously. Mm. I mean, some business is very predictable. The business I work in isn't quite as predictable. Retail is predictable. You know when your peak is generally going to be.
Yeah.
But do you build it in? And then do you start planning? So actually, well, I know my peak's going to be a Black Friday or the December in the UK. You look at it, boom. But you still may think, you know what? I'll have a look. I'll see what the market says. And I'll decide to run my systems in Google tomorrow or Azure tomorrow or however I'm going to do it. But you still have that data. You still have that gravity. You've got to work out how you're going to deal with that problem.
I think the agility one is an interesting one, and this idea that we would suddenly decide we want to spin up, you know, new applications, new services on demand. And I would say that at the moment, if you look at the way that we tend to do things, we're quite rigid in the sense that we don't think that the idea of moving from one cloud provider to another very, very quickly is going to be some sort of thing we can do that's going to have a large amount of benefit to us. Mm. It's relatively impractical, and there'd have to be a big uptick in terms of what it saved you to make it worthwhile. Having said that, as time goes on, as we start seeing more serverless, more Kubernetes-based workloads, containerized workloads, the ability to move the application around will become much easier. And if we've got things like AI workloads where they're more batch processed types of data, then we may look at it and say, do you know what, I'd rather use them today rather than them because I know I can get it cheaper. And all I'm doing is crunching through this petabyte of data, and when that job's done, it's done. So it may well be a different workload types, and over time, we become more agile, or at least want to become more agile, and then we're going to hit that data gravity problem, as you said, and that's something we should come back and talk about, I think.
Yeah. So there's reasons why people want to do it. And it's a conversation which is ongoing, so I'm having a conversation. I know lots of other people in the industry having a conversation. I mean, you start talking about the challenges. How on earth do we do it? Big enterprises talking big data. And I don't mean big data as in AI, ML. I'm just talking about large quantities of zeros and ones.
Yeah.
And moving those quickly is difficult. But there's a whole load of other management issues. There's a cost management issue. As soon as you start spanning multiple clouds, you've got variable costs. You don't know what it will change from day to day. How much you're paying to be stored where. So which of your multi-clouds is growing fastest? Where is your data? Where does it need to be? And then you have the ability. And then if you have all your data, and we take it, if you have just moved 50 petabytes into Amazon, and then I suddenly realize what I really wanted to do was run some AI or ML against that data, and the best place for me to do it is Google. Now, there is the challenge of moving it, which is not going to be quick, but you're also going to be charged to move that data. They make it very easy for you to check your data in, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a tax at the end of the day, isn't it, to make sure that you feel that inertia of moving is actually going to hit you in your pocket. You're not going to just suffer the challenges of physically moving that volume of data, but they're going to financially penalize you for doing it. And I think it raises a lot of questions. So first of all, going back to what you said there, because you covered so many things in that, even in that one little section, First of all, are there any models that you can work out how to work out what your costs are? Because the vendor costs are variable. They charge in different ways, but also the way you access your data changes the way that you're charged or the way that you will incur charging. If you're using no IO in your data, okay, that'll be one sort of profile. If you suddenly do lots of very, very bursty type read and write, it'll be a different type of profile. If you're accessing data that's cold, that doesn't get accessed very often, there might be a retrieval cost. So you almost can't work it out simply because unless you are 100% clear on what the predictability of your data IO model is going to look like, you can't translate that into a cost model. So it's incredibly difficult.
It is. You talk about cold data. Cold data is one of my challenges at the moment. All the cloud providers have a deep cold archive solution. They all set themselves against tape. But if you need that data quickly, say you put it, let's tape it. If you put it to Deep Glacier, for instance, you've got a time to first byte of potentially, I think, 24, 48 hours to get it back. That's the problem with cold data. It's cold until you need it. So potentially tape becomes an interesting option for you. So how do you build a cloud which encompasses that cold data and which actually says, oh, I'm going to put it in tape. But I may want to have processed it in the first place in S3, in Amazon, and it's moving it back. And then making it all seamless to an application. So an application may request something. And actually, but almost probably, one of the problems is code. It brings us back to the mainframe base. We were all quite happy, you know. We would process data and it'd been shifted off to tape. And the application would twiddle its thumbs and wait, and it wouldn't particularly, it would care. You'd care. You'd be like, oh, bloody hell, I'm going to wait another 4 hours to get that back because the tape library's busy, but whatever. But the application wouldn't fall over. But today's development techniques don't cater for that.
Yeah, you're right. There's a number of things there to look at. First of all, do you decide that you should keep multiple copies of data? Well, if it's structured data, so, and by structured data, I mean anything other than just straightforward files and objects. Mm. If it's structured data, keeping it multiple copies of that starts to get you into the copy data management situation where as soon as you've copied it, you've got to keep track of where that live version is. And that's a nightmare when it's structured. You can't share it in two different places easily unless somehow you build that into the application and you start having stretched databases and all sorts of other technologies. If it's unstructured data, that's to a certain degree easier to keep in sync. You know, you could probably keep it in sync, but the challenge is then, do you really want to try and move that data to have it processed in different places, or is it about making it accessible in different places to make it available to be processed? Because those two are two different things. You know, there's no need to physically lift everything out of Amazon to put it in Azure. If you're only going to leave it there for a week, you might as well somehow provide some sort of connectivity between the two where all you're doing is you're abstracting away the logical view of that data from the physical storage so that if you want to access it for a short time, you cache or you use what's available and then you leave it where it was originally. And that minimizes your cost of egress. It gives you some challenges around, you know, metadata consistency so you know where your data is, but that might be a better solution. So I think the solution is to step one above the cloud providers and start looking at tools that can allow you to share that data more effectively.
I do. So I think we end up rapidly in a world of global neighbor spaces to work out how you don't move data unless you absolutely have to. But then those rules for moving data, you need FinOps rules in there, which almost predicts what's good. It actually comes out with the best outcome for you financially. So you may look at things, you may say, well, you look like you're going to be doing this. This transaction historically has cost this. And it may be may you get queried. It may be, and yet again, that was a, do you want to move that data or do you want to keep it as?
Isn't it also being a question of understanding what the profile of the data is? So for instance, if you're doing something where you're looking at a you know, petabyte of AI or data that you're going to put through an AI type process, then latency becomes super critical. So a caching tool that stretches that data across a wide area is really going to struggle because unless you've got some sort of predictability about how you're going to read that data, or you almost can't cache it, especially if it's totally random access where the process you're using is just going through that data semi-randomly, you'll never cache that and you'll hit latency. So you've just got no opportunity there. But if you're doing it with other types of data, it might well be practical to copy it or at least cache it and put it out there for a short time in order to make that work. But it comes back down to that understanding your application and your IO profile again. For example, imagine you're running something that just produces PDFs every time you get a quote for somebody on an insurance system, and then you want to be able to retrieve that quote for somebody in the future. Well, you're not going to care if that is in a system that takes a few milliseconds to get that quote from a different cloud provider. It's all about that IO profile again.
Obviously, your PDF example, there are ways around that. You can do funky things and you just email links and things like that. And you have to, but yet again, it means you have to think about where your data is. And you're thinking about, and developers and things like that have to start thinking about where that data is. How to provide a unique link which will cater for that, but it could be anywhere. It's dealing with that. It's yet again, and so how do we make that transparent? How do you make that invisible to people? So yet again, it comes to this idea of whether it's your storage management or storage orchestration. The conversations I'm having at the moment actually make me feel, in some ways, make me feel very comfortable because it just reminds me of going back to our wonderful mainframe days. A lot of problems we talk about, hang on, that's the way we've always worked.
Yeah, I think the current storage management role, I think, is dying off. Funny enough, I had a conversation with somebody a few weeks ago, back and forth on LinkedIn, and he was just saying how there just didn't seem to be any traditional storage management jobs at all in the area he was looking in, which was financial services in, you know, New York City sort of area. I wonder whether we've done a very good job and we've got to the point where a single person can look after petabytes worth of hardware pretty much. And that's a great thing. And we can automate a huge amount of the problems away as well. And flash has meant that we've got ability to get past unpredictable performance, etc. And I wonder now whether we should be much more focused on data management and how that data interfaces with the application in a multi-cloud environment. And that's now a much bigger challenge to overcome than just straight storage management.
Okay, so I'll take issue with your chat.
Go on then.
So what I found is those traditional storage management jobs still exist.
Okay.
But you won't find them called storage management jobs.
Right.
They're called DevOps jobs, and they're the DevOps. And then you look at the description, and actually they're looking for a storage management person because they've rebranded everybody. Because the problem a lot of companies are finding, if you advertise for one of the traditional infrastructure engineering roles, whether it's Unix sysadmin or a storage management person, people aren't interested. You find that you don't get the application. People don't apply. If you call it DevOps, and then you do or SRE. Or infrastructure SRE, specialism in storage, you'd look at it, Chris, and you'd find that's a storage management job.
That's a bit sneaky, isn't it? But I suppose I can see why you do that in the industry when there's usually a greater demand for people and there are jobs available
to call themselves DevOps as well. People want to call themselves the latest greatest things. Nobody really wants to say, well, I'm a storage monkey or I'm a storage boy. People aren't interested in calling themselves that. They want to be calling themselves DevOps or SRE or there's all kinds of things which people rebrand roles to make them sound more interesting and sexy. I suspect you're probably right. There are less storage management jobs around because if you look at the petabyte per head, well, that's an interesting statement in itself, per petabyte a head. You and I remember when it was per terabyte and almost down to per gigabyte per head. It's never right, but certainly per terabyte per head was a figure.
Definitely.
And I remember looking at the stats, I mean, sort of 15 years ago, and I was stressing about the right ratio was somewhere between 50 and 60 terabytes per head. There are some organisations, my organisation, I would need thousands of people. I just wouldn't have the desk space to do it.
You just couldn't do it, yeah. No, so I had a job in 95-ish, and I looked after 300 gigabytes of storage, which was crazy. Mainframe storage, so it's physical disk, no RAID. You know, the overhead of the work was pretty high, so 300 gig. I would say probably mid-2000s, I was doing some work where we were analyzing customer sites, and we tended to use as a benchmark around 250 terabytes per FTE as our calculation. And then we put that up a bit more towards 400-500 because we thought that seemed more reasonable. So I think bit by bit, we've definitely increased the ability for people to do that. Having said that, the volume of data they're dealing with is also dramatically increasing. But if it's unstructured, there's not a lot to do with it. There's not a lot that can go wrong. There's not a lot you have to really do. And there's tools to sort a lot of those problems out. So the challenge is definitely moving more into how on earth do I get that data in front of the application at the right time and at the right level of performance.
There is. And how do I make that data accessible to an application in a form that the application can understand? Because we live in a world now where certainly file and object are very, very similar. And you may find that you've got a service which wants to speak file, but there's something else which still also wants to accept data, which speaks object. And different cloud providers deal with things in slightly different ways. So how do you make that transfer? How do you make it easy for a developer to talk to that piece of data in the way they want to talk to it?
Yeah. So let's talk about the unstructured stuff, the file and the object, first of all. I see those merging significantly from a technical perspective. And what I mean is I'm not observing it in the market, but I believe that's where that's going to head. And I think the reason for that is because clearly vendors have already started to merge their products, and they put gateways in front of object stores, and they put object stores in front of file systems. And, you know, there's a merging of the technology there. There's a slightly different IO profile, and there's some other issues around things like locking and so on, and some benefits of a file system over a dumb object store that are really relevant and still have to keep. But in general, we're even seeing vendors who can produce in a traditional dual array controller type footprint, a petabyte worth of storage. So we don't need that scale out object store anymore, unless we really want to drive performance, or we want to distribute geographically or something like that, or in separate racks or something like that. So those two seem to be coming together quite neatly. And maybe that's probably a good thing from the object store vendor's point of view, because it is an opportunity for them both to become more relevant, I think. So I see those merging quite consistently together.
But there's some challenges, certainly around file, or how these objects are wrapped so they look files and vice versa. A lot of people and we talked about that. The advantage of object is you could scale it out. You can make massive object stores. Well, we've seen some pretty large file stores, to be honest.
Yeah.
The cluster file systems are huge. I mean, you look at a Spectrum scale GPFS, they're massive. So where's object's real advantage against file? And actually, this is stuff which people tend to forget. It's things like the metadata tagging, the tagging. It's all the stuff you can do that. But that has some implementation-specific problems. But file also does have metadata. We forget about what files do have metadata. They have security metadata at raw level, file permissions, and ACLs are metadata. So you're right, I can see them converging, but I can see that's going to get bumpy at times. And yeah. I can see there's going to be protocol wars. I think we can end up back in protocol wars again. And we've seen, I mean, so we have this pseudo standard of S3. I say it's pseudo standard because Amazon control it. It's not in Amazon's best interest to break it. But there are extensions to S3, which we've already seen. Spectralogic have extended S3 to support Black Pearl, to support Tape.
Yeah. I think Scalacy have done the same thing for some additional pieces they wanted to add around geodistribution. Yeah. I think Cloudian did the same thing to allow them to do more complex tiered management of the data up and down between tiers and, you know, the archiving and the aging. So I think vendors have tweaked around the edges and added their own small extensions to it where possible.
There's lots of things you can do with objects. You can do, you can set expiry data and you can get time to die. But that's not new. We can take that back to Centera days.
Yeah.
And Centera, I mean, we forget Centera is basically, in many ways, it's an object store.
In more recently, you've had OpenIO who did things where they were processing on triggers when objects came into the object store. I think vendors have realized that they need to put automation behind content. Hammerspace have done some really interesting stuff where you can set your metadata and put rules in place to move data around. So it seems like, at least on a conceptual basis, there are solutions out there that are trying to address this, but are they trying to address it in a multi-cloud world?
I don't believe so. There are people in my space have started to look at, but they're all built on, some are built on very traditional IT infrastructure. There's a UK company called Pixit who have a product which is just built on Spectrum scale. It's basically Spectrum scale on steroids. It allows you to move things around. It's very cool. It looks quite nice. It's interesting. But then again, you've got more traditional vendors. You've got NetApp. So for a long time, I was looking at NetApp's data fabric, and I was thinking, what's the point? I still don't think they sell it particularly well.
Yeah.
But I do think there's probably some value in that, but it still feels a bit fragmented at the moment.
Yeah.
How do you feel? I know you've looked a bit at data fabric.
I'd agree with you. I think it is definitely fragmented, and it was a collection of different techniques to move data around in different ways. So some of it might have been using native replication within ONTAP. Some of it might have been a cloud data mover that was moving stuff between S3 and other places. So there was a mixture of different techniques they were using to achieve that. When we saw them announce Project Astra last week, I think that was a first stage attempt to try and put some sort of veneer across the whole lot so that you can abstract a little bit away from the underlying tools and processes that are actually doing the work underneath. Because obviously with that, for example, you have to have some sort of NetApp hardware or service somewhere. So it could be in the cloud or it could be on-premises with ONTAP, but you do need to have a NetApp product somewhere. Their plan is at some point, it's claiming, to support other vendors outside of that. Now, we know that that could be difficult without direct access to some platforms. It certainly would be difficult if the only way you've got in to get in and out of the platform is a traditional protocol. I can see that's what they're trying to do. I think they're trying to create that consistency and standardization around it. And the acquisition of Spot brings them the cost management and the ability to start looking at the costs and understanding that a bit more. So you could see that there is a starting of something coming, but it just seems to be such a long journey for us to be on to get to something that's going to be actually useful.
Yeah, your acquisition of Spot, it definitely is interesting. I think, but who knows, at some point we'll end up running a storage accountancy podcast, financial operations for storage.
It would be fascinating because we've moved way past the idea of simply accounting for things in dollars per gigabyte. Even we've gone past the TCO side of things that we would have seen traditionally when we thought about a TCO. And it's just become super complex because you've got a much greater model to understand in terms of data flow, data costs, how those costs translate into charges. And then how do you even bill it back to an internal customer within the business if you're trying to be consistent about saying to them, come to us and we'll give you multi-cloud access. You know, wherever you want to put your data, we'll help you do it. How do you charge the business for that? Mm. That's just even that is really tricky.
And then bringing the cloud providers, the big cloud providers, is it in their interest to make this easier multi-cloud to do? I mean, they've all beginning woken up to the fact that people will still want to do stuff on-premises. We've seen various moves to put footholds or bridgeheads into your data center. I think the original focus was to make it easy for you to move your data into the cloud, so they've got to it. But I think there's a grudging acceptance that certainly large enterprises will want to continue to just do a significant amount of their compute and storage on their own premises. But what I've not seen them is any of them enabling you to do multi-cloud, not putting bridgeheads into their competitors to allow people to have that abstraction to allow them to deal with anything. I suppose we could argue some of the stuff which Google have done with their Kubernetes, it's not storage, but that idea is starting to come, that they accept the fact you're going to run your workload anywhere. Do they ensure it's a level playing field? Do they just make sure we pay lip service to it, but we'll make it really hard for you to run a workload in another cloud provider? We'll probably support you for running on-premises stuff. We understand that. That's pragmatic. But allowing you to consume services from another cloud provider easily.
Okay. So, well, let's think this through then. So, first of all, we're in a market that's continuing to grow for the cloud providers, for the big guys anyway. Year on year, they're ramping it up. They haven't really yet hit a peak of the growth of their business. So at this point, they're not competing with each other too heavily in the sense that there's an increased number of customers and there's an increased amount of money coming into the market that they can acquire. So they're not having to be super competitive between each other at this point and steal stuff from each other or even work together in a sort of frenemies type way either. So what happens? You know, where are they going to look to make their money in the future? Are they going to continue to build data centers where they build literally half the planet becomes data centers for Amazon and Google and all the rest of it? Or do they look at it like the infrastructure vendors have looked at it over the years and said, do you know what? I don't see any benefit of being in the hardware business. I see benefit being in the software business. So instead of selling you a virtual machine and all you do is run your workload on it, they want an increasingly larger part of the pie of the applications running in that virtual machine, because then they're making more money out of you. So maybe what we'll see is them care less about the storage of physical data and more about selling you the services that process that data. And then they can make their infrastructure effectively become more cost effective for them, because you're buying more services from them, more complex services from them that use maybe, you know, the database service or an AI service or something else. It's not just you buying a vanilla VM from them, which they will make, you know, not very much out of. So I would have thought that the long-term value for the cloud people is to try and sell you much more complex and value-add services that do stuff on data than just to charge you for infrastructure pass-through costs, which is effectively what they're doing with S3.
I've got silent, so I try to think. I've almost feels like what we've just said is everybody's aim is eventually to get out of hardware.
Yeah.
But at some point, somebody's going to have to do it.
I know that's impossible, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's not a case of getting out of hardware per se. It's about increasing your share of the pie of the value add, which is always the software. So instead of just selling you a VM and you go off to Oracle and buy a license from Oracle and put it on the cloud, they're trying to sell you their version of the database, which runs on their cloud. And then they'll try and sell you additional add-on services that process that data or back it up. Or maybe you apply AI over the top of that data. So you're not necessarily increasing the physical infrastructure, but you're increasing the value of the services that are running on that infrastructure. And that's how they increase their revenue in the future.
But then the question is, as we said, one of the reasons is you look at multi-cloud is each cloud vendor tends to do something better than the other one. So what you would quite like to be able to do is run a service in one cloud which talks to another service in another cloud. So you may say you decided that Amazon's databases are the best thing in the world, right? But you decided that the way Google, for instance, scale out web services is the best thing in the world. So how do you how do they enable you to have best of breed, or do you just always find that you're compromising, which we do at the moment?
That is a super interesting question, because at the end of the day, we started this conversation off saying about when you're looking at doing multi-cloud, there's got to be some real financial benefit. Either you need to be able to do something that builds a service that you couldn't build otherwise, so therefore you get competitive advantage from doing it, or there's got to be enough of a cost reduction to make it worthwhile. Now, I think perhaps that's the area that will make it not worthwhile to mix and match those services to that degree, because there's almost no benefit in having double dependency, one on one cloud provider, one on another. You haven't gained anything, by the way, have you, if you think about it? Because if either one goes down or either one has an issue, your system has an issue. But where do you, you know, how can you show that that's incrementally going to save you a lot of money than it is just putting it all in one place? Maybe the use cases for this sort of stuff become so minimal that you'll only see a very small amount of sharing in the real value areas where it makes sense to do so. Mm. But it's a tricky one. I mean, again, it comes back to that understanding your data, understanding the model, and understanding what savings you could possibly make by actually implementing a multi-cloud strategy, which is fascinating.
Well, it is fascinating, and it brings us back to a very, very old trope in the world of computing. My operating system's better than yours. But instead of your operating system, you're saying, well, but GCP is better than Azure, which is better than this. And if you think about all the challenges we've had over the past 20, 30 years, getting various different operating systems to talk to each other efficiently, because you say, actually, well, you want your Linux box to talk nicely to your Windows box because there are some things you want to do. So do we move away from the operating system wars to fanboys of cloud providers who then sit there saying, well, I won't use anything but GCP, or I won't use anything but Azure because the other one's rubbish?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that whole idea of operating system wars, I think, was partly driven by the fact that, say Microsoft, for example, Microsoft owning the Office products had a super competitive advantage in the sense that they provided a super lock-in to the platform, because until they decided they were going to run those Office products on, say, Mac, if you wanted to run Office or Excel or PowerPoint, you were running them on a Windows machine. There was 100% lock-in on that. So will the cloud providers do something similar where they just will not release, they acquire technology that can't be got anywhere else, and then they become unique because of that and do the same sort of thing, and then they build in that uniqueness? It's a shame, but maybe it's a natural evolution of the way people do business that they want to find any way possible to keep you tied to their platform, just simply because that's their way of keeping you locked into their revenue. You'd hope that wasn't the case, but you can see that could definitely happen.
Well, yeah. So what is that killer application which means you're willing to accept suboptimal performance on other applications?
I don't think there is one at the moment, though, is there? I mean,
I don't think there is at the moment.
No. I can't think of anything that one cloud provider over another has in terms of a killer piece of technology that gives them some sort of degree of control. Could it be something like, for sake of argument, Amazon are building out 5G network, aren't they? They're building out their own additional network across one of the mobile bands. You know, will it come down to something like that, like ubiquitous access to data in any city, in any place, so that if you want to build out an IoT environment for your workloads, you know all you've got to do is just switch on a switch on a device and it's immediately on the Amazon network, and that's your lock-in networking. whereas the other providers can't do that. You have to spend so much more on infrastructure to make that work. And then they give you a secure network and they give you all the other things that go with it. Could it be something like that, where they give you ubiquity of access rather than necessarily ubiquity of data?
Oh, it could be. I tell you what I'm seeing more of. I'm seeing Amazon lockers spring up all over the place. Well, you could probably hide some 5G servers in some of those.
Yeah.
And they become your edge data centers. Yeah.
Absolutely. But you can see that maybe Microsoft has to go and buy a global telecoms provider, and they have to get back into the networking business again. How mad would that be? Vendors wanted to get out of that sort of business. I mean, IBM sold off their networking business, didn't they, years ago? Not wide area networking, but they had a networking business.
Oh, they did.
You know, people sold off all of those things thinking, oh, they'll move to commodity. They'll become stuff that doesn't really have any value, so it'll be low cost, low margin. And that was probably true for the market we were in at the time. But I wonder whether things like that might come back and say, well, actually, do you know what? We now could get competitive advantage if we had a global carrier network or a global network of IoT connected 5G devices. So we may see things come back into the cloud providers where they grab back pieces of infrastructure or technology that gives them that just that extra advantage over somebody else.
Well, we're running out of time.
Yep.
And I think this conversation's gone all over the place. I think
you're kidding.
We're talking about multi-cloud storage. I think we've talked about pretty much almost everything else as well.
Yeah.
But I think it's been a really interesting conversation. I mean, it'd be really interesting to hear what our listeners have experienced, what they think the problems are. So I'd quite like to speak to some vendors as well. What are they doing to provide this unified storage space which spans multi-cloud across all the cloud providers on premises? Where do they see the challenges? Do they find dealing with the cloud providers themselves a challenge as well?
It's a part of the market, I think, that is going to become increasingly more relevant, but is probably one of the most complex things to resolve. And that's somehow to stitch all of these different services together, both from a data/storage fabric, but also to layer on the applications on top of that, and then to deal with things like data protection, security, resiliency, and everything else. Because you're not even just talking about the ability to make your data available in one place or another. You're having to make sure it meets all those other requirements as well. So vendors have got a massive opportunity here, as well as a big problem. And I think if there's a vendor or two that comes along with some really good ideas, they could have a real killer opportunity to make some big money.
Yeah, I think so. But as you said, it's very complex. I wonder which vendor will embrace it and whether we'd ever see a startup being able to embrace it, because it just seems to be the problem space seems to be massive.
Yeah, that's probably going to be one of the biggest challenges, is who leads the way and tries to fix the problem. And clearly, you know, we've seen NetApp as an example we've talked about earlier. I don't know what Dell or Dell EMC or whatever they call themselves this week are doing in that area, because they obviously are one of the biggest infrastructure providers, if not the biggest. What are HPE doing? These vendors are sitting in that sort of space where they could potentially gain an awful lot more control if they focused on the data side of it rather than the infrastructure side. You know, maybe it's somebody like that, those existing solutions providers, that have to take a big leap of faith and try and transform themselves into something else.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So let's hope that we do get some vendors give us a shout, because I think we could have some interesting conversations. I think there's plenty out there who are trying to solve this problem in a piecemeal way, but I'd like to see who's trying to solve it in a bigger picture way, other than, say, just NetApp. That'd be really interesting to see.
Well, yeah, I think recently we've recorded a lot of podcasts which very much is very, very local, talking about local processing, the things like fungible, the composable infrastructure. And that feels like that's one problem space. But then there is a problem space of this composable infrastructure or composable cloud.
Yeah.
So composability, I think, over the next 10 years could be something to watch.
Absolutely. So on that note, I think that's a good time to wrap up. Martin, yeah. What a great conversation. Really enjoyed that. And I think it's given us many other different angles to go and dive into. But I think it's hopefully has given people some degree of pause to think about what their challenges are going to be going forward. So let's see what response we get, and catch up next time.
Cool. Cheers, Chris.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.